Breakfast with the Browns
on CITR 101.9 FM every Monday morning
from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m.
The older I get, the more life starts to make sense, and the less I care.
Now we're riding the rainbow across it, and we're making it like him. Now we're riding the rainbow to Cloudsville, and we're making it like you. Now we're riding the rainbow to Cloudsville.
You know, you can give 100 examples of what it isn't, but man, you're going to have a hell of a time saying what it is.
You're listening to CITR 101.9. Broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
May is Asian Heritage Month, and the Museum of Anthropology is inviting you to celebrate with them by seeing the exhibition Traces of Words, Art and Calligraphy from Asia, on from May 11th to October 9th. Words and their physical manifestations are explored in this exhibition, which will honor the special significance that written forms, especially calligraphy, hold across many unique cultures of Asia, a vast geographical area boasting the greatest diversity of languages in the world. Join MOA for the exhibit's opening with free admission on Thursday, May 11th from 7 to 10 p.m.
Hey, this is Noah from Christ on Parade, and you are listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, BC, Canada.
Where's Matt? Hello, you are listening to Shoes on a Wire on CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Madeline Taylor, and I'm broadcasting to you right now from the unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people at the University of British Columbia. So last week, something happened that I want to talk about today before we start the show. There was a show put on by a popular local band. I went to it on the weekend. It was really good. The show was packed, super high energy, and the bands played really well. What was notable to me, though, was the poster. Little bit controversial, and a lot of people don't necessarily know what it was about, which is perhaps a good thing. So the poster depicted a mouse in armor holding a sword pointing to the sky. Skewered on the sword were the heads of three known men in the music scene. Through the rumor mill, I and lots of other people have heard allegations against some of these guys that they are violent in various ways towards women. These rumors have circulated for years, but I've never seen a band, let alone a male-fronted band, take a public stand against any of them. I guess I can guess why. The social consequences of standing up to abusers in positions of power like this are very real, especially when the people who are accused have a lot of clout, a lot of social clout, and a lot of social power in what they're doing around the scene. So probably the reason that the women involved and who have been allegedly abused haven't made public declarations about their experiences. Interestingly, in a post-Gomeshi arts culture, many people's first instinct is to actually trust survivors, which is another new thing. So the context around these conversations is very different. Women don't tend to stand up in these situations because the personal consequences of dealing with abuse in your personal life are destructive enough as it is. Taking a public stance is a huge risk, but this band, because of their popularity, they can handle it. Many other bands could too, but you don't see it happening very often. And it's really refreshing to see abuse called out even in a small way that isn't necessarily explicit to anyone not already in the know about what was going on. But that's the thing about abuse, is that people talk about it, survivors talk, and we live in a moment where more people are willing to listen. But the criminal justice system doesn't work for all of them. So the accused deserve fair trials and the chance to face their accusers, but we know that survivors of physical and sexual abuse rarely see justice through the formal criminal justice system. Talking about it and dealing with it as a community seems like a healthy alternative and a way to build support and care around survivors of abuse so that this doesn't continue to happen to other women in the future for years and years. So my hope is that more people in positions of power will start to do the same thing, so we aren't only communicating about abuse through the rumor mill and the whisper network. With that, here's a song from one of my new favorite bands. They're brand new. This is a demo. The band is called Necking, and the song is called Stop Singing. It does have a couple swear words, so if you have children in your car right now, you may want to flip the channel real quick. Otherwise, enjoy. They'll be playing Music Waste, I think, so keep an eye out for them in the next couple months. Again, this is Necking with Stop Singing.
Your car and your grandfather's yacht that
That was the Courtneys with Silver Velvet on CITR 101.9 FM, and you are listening to Shoes on a Wire. The song you heard before that was Birthday Bitch with Harwich. Lots of ch noises. Birthday Bitch played this weekend at Andy Social Skate Shop, opening for Weed and Puzzlehead, and it was quite a time. It was a great time. Yes. Okay. At this point in the show, I am going to introduce to you the interview that I did for this week. So a few weekends ago, it was Record Store Day on April 23rd. I believe it was a Saturday. It was very rainy and cold outside. Nonetheless, Vancouverites all over the place lined up for lots of time to go to their favorite places. I spent the early afternoon meeting up with Casey Way, who's a local musician and artist, in Chinatown to talk about her most recent project, the Karaoke Free Store. And I walked up to the art space on Kiefer Street, went through the two plywood doors to find a big studio transformed into a soundstage painted entirely in green screen, which was pretty interesting. It was very sparse, very cold, but Casey and I sat down and did our interview on the floor. In this first part, we talk about her project and how it's positioned in Chinatown.
I was going to go to Audio Pile, but the lineup was around the block, and that was at 11:15 before the rain started. It was a bummer. I also wanted to look at Brian Eno Records and Always David Bowie Records and My Bloody Valentine Records, but I didn't get a chance to. There's just like a lineup of dudes.
Yeah.
They're all dudes.
Tell me
dudes.
Who you are.
My name is Casey. I am an artist and musician and person who lives in Vancouver. I play in the band Late Spring, and I am also a solo project named Hazy, and I started this label called Agony Club a year ago that I'm currently pursuing pretty full on, and also just working on this karaoke shop for this month pretty full on.
Tell me, where are we right now?
We are in the Unit Pit Projects Artist Run Center in Chinatown. It's on 236 East Pender, and normally there are exhibitions here, as you would expect, like white walls, artwork that's open to the public. But for this month, for this project that I'm doing, the Karaoke Music Video Free Store, I've transformed the gallery into a Karaoke Music Video Free Store, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's like a pop-up shop. Like, I've envisioned it as kind of like how you would imagine like a Sears portrait studio, but instead of getting still like photos taken of you, you have an hour long session free to come in to make a karaoke. I will make you a karaoke music video where I'll shoot the video in a number of takes, and then I'll edit it all together in a desirable music video way.
Yeah, it feels like we're sort of stepping out of like the neighborhood once we get into this green area.
Yeah,
it's interesting.
Yeah, and there's black curtains covering the light cut that would otherwise be coming in through the front. And it's interesting where, like, the door is open and there's a monitor against the front of the gallery, kind of playing the rushes of the week, of just footage and a little ad spot, like advertising to the community outside what's going on in here. So once in a while we'll get like people poking their nose in and curious but also hesitant. And I've been really trying to like get somebody who either works around Chinatown or that I don't know, or just a passerby, to be interested enough to take it on, but that hasn't happened.
Not yet.
I mean, I've gotten strangers, complete strangers in the world, that have come through either seeing this listing in Discorder or the Georgia Strait and on Instant Coffee, just like online mostly, or through like just various advertisements, but not just like like a passerby. And I think it's also a bit maybe difficult where, like, if you were passing by and suddenly you saw this and you were into the idea, I probably wouldn't be able to accommodate the request, like, right away, because people do make hour-long appointments. So it's not really, like, there's some... It's not, like, as impromptu as I would like it to be, but that's the nature of video as opposed to the nature of, like, taking a still photo, I guess. So,
yeah, it's a little bit more labor-intensive.
Yeah.
I know you talked about this a little bit in the web-exclusive interview that you did for Discorder recently, but mm-hmm. can you talk about where this project idea came from and why you've decided to put your time into it?
That's like a very existential question. Where I'm like, why do I do any of this? I'm so tired. I always feel like at the end of the day, in visual art, like the most satisfaction and like way I can justify an art practice for myself is to like have some kind of way to like very literally engage with the world around me. Like if I'm in my studio, I'm like doing quotations, like, which is like my studio means like my computer at my desk in my bedroom making stuff, I feel super like more alone than I already feel, and that is a process that's like part B of the process of this project, where right now I'm in part A just shooting, but I feel like I need both parts for myself to feel like what I'm doing is actually important. And and so like, yeah, and that comes in my practice. This project came from these happenings I did, like at Kingsgate Mall a few years ago, did Kingsgate Mall happenings, and then I did another happenings in Chinatown Center Mall in Toronto for Images Festival. And at both happenings, the karaoke days were always the most successful. Like there was just no reservations. Everybody just loved it so much, and naturally this project came out of that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, over the course of like a couple of years, it wasn't like a right away kind of thing, like one thing led to the other, kind of simmered and sat. And as I became more involved in the music community in Vancouver, that also had a lot to do with it too, I think. Yeah. Where a lot of people who have come to this music video karaoke maker free store are people I've seen kind of around in the music community and visual art community, but haven't necessarily gotten a chance to talk to, and this has been an interesting and a nice way to connect. Yeah.
So just taking your personal practice into a public setting, mm-hmm. and like making the actual acts of your practice all about engaging with people.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not very good at like hanging out. I'm way better at like it's a work hall kind of thing where like I like connecting with people when there's like sounds weird, just like a purpose or like a project to work on. I find that easier to do than just like actually hanging out. That's my own weird thing though. But this project and most of I guess the things that I do have that collaborative element in it, where I guess through like making an artwork with someone or in like being involved in some creative process with someone, you get to know people in this way I find very like valuable.
So walk me through what happens when someone shows up and they're like, I'm here for my karaoke appointment. This is the song I want to do.
Okay.
Like, what is your sort of directorial and coaching process like?
It can vary a little bit depending on how comfortable someone is, but generally it's like, okay, we'll cue it up on YouTube. I'll do a lighting check. I'll like let them know where is the best spot for them to stand in the beginning, because there are shadows to kind of work around, and then letting them know that, okay, we need to do this more than once, because some people have this idea of like, oh, I'll just perform it once and I'll be done. But like, no, if you want the music video to look good, we need to do it at least like two or three times. But not overdoing it, because then if you do like seven takes, you know, you're like tired and mm-hmm. bored of the song by like take five. So anyway, like, yeah, just marking them in the shot, doing a levels check, because I'm recording their vocals separately into a Zoom recorder, so I want the sound to be kind of good. And then doing like half of the song as like a test take, and then just shooting. And everything's very kind of like step by step, and not very, there's no like, you know, whatever that cue card is, it's not very cinematic or glamorous. It's just kind of like very procedural and low key, which I think is helpful and relaxing. Mm-hmm. And I think some people have been like worried, like, are there going to be people around?
Yeah.
Is it open to the public in that way? And it's like, no, it's really about being comfortable in kind of like you're in a disembodied place doing this, performing for no one, for the camera basically. So performing for no one, and I just want to be as invisible as I possibly can while kind of also having like a direction in mind. Because the thing with this project, it's like I've already shot, I think, about 30 videos, and the challenge will be to like make each one kind of unique, and that's something that I'm like always like mindful of. So when somebody comes in, I haven't really met them, I don't know them, but then just throughout the takes, like not necessarily I'll have the idea like set, but then it'll get closer to something that's unique to them performing that song, like the way I'm shooting it. And that's always like something that happens maybe by the third take. So it is, I do need the hour-long session with a person.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you find that you have to do much like emotional coaching to encourage people to get out of their head about it?
Or no.
Pretty comfortable?
Most people are pretty comfortable. Maybe even they're not that comfortable, but they're here and willing to do it. And I'm not really like good at being in like, okay, like being a cheerleader kind of person. I'm just pretty like level about like, okay, we need to do it again. Okay, and I'm going to try to do it again from this shot. Is that okay? And they're most of the time just like okay about that. But after like the third take, they're usually, some people have been kind of like, really?
Yeah.
One more? And then if I let them know, well, you know, if you want it to look good, we should do it once more, please. And they're fine with it. Yeah.
Do you have a favorite video that you've produced so far?
Mm.
Or one that you're really excited about?
The one actually, Britt was just in here with two friends. So it was like a three-person video, and they, instead of doing a like a song with words, they did an interpretive dance with the mirrors that you see in here. There's like these kind of like big full-bodied mirrors that they kind of held and danced around in this green screen zone with, and it was like an 8-minute long ambient song called Iona by Lossal, who was like playing at Red Cat today or something. And it's just been so refreshing, because every other video I've shot has been just like people like performing a song, and this one is gonna just look like super freaky and weird and good. So I'm excited about that, because it just happened. And also I'm in this mode of like shooting and forgetting, so it's kind of hard for me to like think back to what happened last week.
In the Discord or Web exclusive where you were initially interviewed about this project, or maybe not initially, but interviewed by Discorder,
mm-hmm.
You were talking about how karaoke is sort of a democratizing force.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, like I feel like once a pop song becomes a karaoke version of itself, it's its own thing. I mean, even when a pop song is like, you know, exists in the world outside of the artist performing it live, if a person who listens to it relates to it and likes it enough to remember all the words, it becomes its own thing, and it's not about the artist performing the song that is theirs anymore. Like that ownership kind of like dissolves or disappears or like mutates in this like interesting way once you make something and just release it into the world. And it's probably in a way that the artist will never know, but like when, as I'm imagining myself like as like I don't know, like David Bowie, if I knew that 20 of my songs were karaoke versions, had karaoke versions, that would just mean that, like, I mean, they're strong enough for people to like really make it theirs. And that's kind of like this nice imagined feeling I would have if I was like that artist. But like on the other side of like, yeah, every time I do perform a karaoke song or see people perform a karaoke song, it's like it's totally their own. Like just because the song exists, someone else wrote it and has performed it in a certain way and set the foundation of what it can be, it doesn't stop like changing every time somebody sings it. Like a person in the world sings, and that's somehow very, that's kind of why I love music, I guess, or like pop music, or like that's the idea, or that's the driving force behind why we do it, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One thing I find interesting about karaoke is like it originated in Japan,
mm-hmm.
right? And you're taking this project into historic Chinatown in mm-hmm. Vancouver, and I've always loved, because there's this terrible stereotype of Japanese culture is very reserved, mm-hmm. and karaoke is this like extremely performative, hilarious, fun thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, did you think about any of that when you were coming up with this project idea?
No. Because I mean, now I am, and I feel like that stereotype is like kind of true. Like Japanese society being seen as like kind of reserved, and Japanese people are more reserved than I don't know, like North American people, maybe perhaps. But that's also like not fair. It's like a gross generalization, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm just thinking about karaoke and how it functioned. My idea or understanding of it in Japan, it's like a thing that like drunk businessmen would do to like blow off steam or something. There'd be kind of like hostesses or something involved,
right.
And I think like that is very different from the karaoke that happens here,
yeah.
in the West, or and the evolution of that. I haven't. Like the way it's changed, and maybe like the way it's changed, it's like changed over here, and the way we do it over here kind of has changed maybe how it's seen in Japan. And is Japan the first place that did karaoke?
I'm not sure. That's always been my assumption based on like the word.
Yeah. That makes totally sense. Because I know in Korea they call it like norebang or something, but it's like the same thing. Or just the idea, the doing karaoke in private rooms as opposed to like on a stage, and it's way more about some kind of cathartic group experience with a close, that's kind of intimate, as opposed to like being a performer on a stage and exercising that kind of like individual narcissism. Because I feel like it is kind of narcissistic and always like wanting, like being on stage and wanting to be looked at, no matter if it's your own song or like someone else's song. That's an element of karaoke that I think is important to, or just like to address. It's not like good or bad, it's just something that is a part of it. But like karaoke in a group, in an intimate group with your friends or your coworkers in a contained room is like a completely different experience, I think. It's way more like personal or something, but like about the people you're with, as opposed to like you exercising like some kind of like performer's dream or dream of being a performer.
Yeah, it's kind of like playtime.
Yeah. Or like in which one? Both or just
I think both.
On stage?
Both, but I think more so when you're in a room with just your friends.
It's more playtime. Oh yeah, that's like slumber party time or something. Yeah. Yeah, oh sorry, I'm just like thinking about the Chinatown thing now, where I mean the only reason it's in Chinatown is because like Unit Pit projects and a lot of artist run centers right now are located in historic Chinatown, and this whole conversation of like gentrification and what it means to be an artist run center in or an artist or a musician like being a force in gentrification, like it's been for like I guess many decades now, but it's coming to a point where we can't even afford to live in the places that we're gentrifying. So that's interesting. And that's kind of informed like why the project is advertised in both like Cantonese/Mandarin and in English, because I do want to engage with the community that I'm physically in. And also for me that means just like working quote unquote here for the month in an everyday kind of way, and just kind of going around to local businesses and like checking things out or like buying baked goods, and being someone who is Chinese who grew up in Vancouver, but I haven't really had to spend a lot of time in Chinatown for work, or my studio's never really been here necessarily. It's been more in Mount Pleasant. It's an interesting way to like see how I'm choosing to engage with the businesses, like which places I go to that I think are okay, and which places I'm just like I don't really want to set foot in, because I feel like it is very like somehow some beacon of gentrification that I don't want to support.
Yeah.
I won't name names, but we all know which ones are and which ones aren't. We all have ours.
That was the first part of my conversation with Casey Wei at her karaoke music video free store in Chinatown. We spoke on Record Store Day about 2 weeks ago. Up next is the second half of our conversation, where we talk about existential dread in the production of art and her current project and main project, Agony Club Press, the most recent issue of that magazine and compilation tape came out in March. So this is part two of my interview with Casey Wei. You are listening to Shoes on a Wire on CITR 101.9 FM.
Watching Black Mirror and The Sopranos, a strangely complementary pair. I'm in the final season of the latter, and ever since Tony came out of his coma dreamland, I've stopped caring. I'm waiting for Matthew Weiner to pull me back in, but I suspect that the cold, Weiner-esque moral ambiguity of Mad Men, which I loved, isn't going to work in Tony's world. It's too close to the present. And then there's Black Mirror, a modern-day Twilight Zone. Is it frightening or comforting to imagine that this coupling of apathy and dread is something the collective consciousness has been exercising through television since the 50s? Our doomsday clocks have just synced, so does that mean it can only get better? The looming dread I feel sits in a strange pocket of affect, collecting dust, ignored but expanding. An itchy coalescence of pain, pleasure, and desire removed from itself. Always trying to figure out the why of why we bother to try to make anything. I think that my answer for right now is anyway. I don't want to be removed from the pain, pleasure, or desire. I want to scratch the itch.
I've read that editor's note probably like six times at this point, because I really like when you start talking about affect and the idea of doomsday clocks. Now this was, I'm guessing you wrote this right after the U.S. presidential election, or sort of with that in mind. Is there anything besides that that makes you think that doomsday is happening now, or like that gives you that sense of overwhelming dread, or is it really just synced to that event?
I think it's something that I think we're all over the, I don't know, however many years, like since the millennium, since like Y2K or something, been like picking up, it's been picking up speed, especially a lot of things with the environment where like, you know, there's always been news about it, but it seems like it's becoming more and more pressing, like, you know, by 2020, like, half these species will be dead, or the coral reef will no longer exist, and, like, that's coming up really soon. So I feel like there's this growing, this pressing urgency that's, like, getting more and more intense, and the presidential election that was, like, in our North American world, the biggest, like, what am I trying to say? It's, like, the biggest symbolic, like, like, somebody slapped us all in the face at the same time. And it was really just, like shocking, even though we all sort of knew it was like kind of coming for a long time. So that's what I was responding to with that letter, I guess. And especially after that feeling, like, you know, that hopelessness of like, well, why are we making art or music right now? It seems so trivial. And I know that's like, I mean, it's not like you can just stop doing that and like become an activist overnight or something, you know, but it does seem like, you know, calling to calling some sort of reevaluation of why we're doing things. Because I mean, like, to be a successful like indie band, or to make paintings or art or comics or zines and stuff, it's like, we, no matter how satisfying it is, or cool we think it is, or like valuable we think it is, we are most of the time just like distributing it amongst ourselves. And it's really hard to like get that crossover action to make a difference in somebody who doesn't care about that sort of shit to actually care or to see why we're even doing it. Because mm-hmm. most of the time I feel like there's this division of like us versus them, like the normal people and people like who work kind of part-time jobs to sustain like a tiny studio to make obscure drawings or something like that. You know, it's this weird stereotype division thing. And I think with this project, it's just like my way of trying to engage with that crossover a little bit, or mm-hmm. try to anyway.
Yeah. You're not the first person I've had that conversation with where mm-hmm. it's like, why are we making music right now? Like, mm-hmm. what is the point of this sort of organizing? We should all be focused on politics.
Yeah.
And like, yeah, it sounds like this project is one of the things that you've done with that sort of sense of existential dread, but mm-hmm. like, is there any other way that you're interpreting it?
This project?
No, your dread.
Oh, my dread.
Where does it go?
It goes into making the work, I guess, which is, you know, and also it goes, where else does it go? I don't know, it just kind of floats around. It never goes away, I guess. But I feel like the only, like, how do I relate this to this next thought I have? I really can't. The only thing I've just really become more adamant about is being vocal about how important it is to, like, care, whether it's, like, care or thinking about like why we're doing this and then continuing to do so with that, not necessarily a static answer, but just a continual like questioning of like, oh, so I have a studio in Chinatown, or I'm making artwork in Chinatown, and how does that affect the environment I'm in? Like, I feel like that's a really obvious question, but I don't know if it is. Like, it's obvious to me, but I don't feel like it's not an obvious question because there's no obvious easy answer. And like just asking those questions and looking, like being introspective, I think is valuable and like important in becoming a politicized being. It's not just like, oh yeah, this business is bad, I'm gonna buy coffee somewhere else. It's like not, it's not so like, it's more systemic and like deeper than that. And it's really hard to make that into to shape that and to have that to see that in subtle ways, not in your practice as a musician or an artist, but like in your like in the way you like interact with the world that might like affect how you would even naturally go about making art or music.
It seems sort of like a personal aspect of resistance,
mm-hmm.
where you're engaging with ideas like gentrification or, you know, political doom. Through creating joy and experience with like people who are maybe not immediately in your community, mm-hmm. but related to your community or curious about your community,
yeah.
as an artist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like that understanding is just all I'm really looking for. Where it's, I don't need for people to understand me like in a personal way, but just, or and vice versa, but just like kind of understanding each other's desire for expression in a way that manifests itself in visual art and music, like two very broad but also very specific like non-language, it is capital based, but like in a way where we idealize it. So questioning that idyllic thought of like making art and music in a way that's not embedded in capitalism, that's something that I think is important. And then we don't maybe address, I didn't really address as much until like the whole election thing happened, where I'm like, the system's why am I making art and music in this way that the system like propagates or like supports? You know that like it was before, or like it was screwed up before, but now it seems like somehow more.
Yeah.
Like, it crossed some sort of line.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's more out in the open. It's not hiding anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's like, that was one thing about the whole free store idea that I liked.
Mm-hmm.
Just the title free store, like, I've seen that in, like, a couple different, you know, Gulf Islands where you can just, like, literally go into a place and buy things and leave things with, mm-hmm. like, free libraries and stuff.
Yeah.
But, like, pairing those two words in a place that is, like, a business district, mm-hmm. I thought was really interesting. And because, like, you're doing all this work, but mm-hmm. you're not monetizing it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's very anti-capitalist practice.
And the way that I'm able to do this is I got, like a grant, and, like, you know, Unipid has some money, so they're, like, paying me to do this. So it's not like I'm just able to do this out of my own, like, pocket or, you know, I'm not rich or anything. So there's some... It's just, like, kind of, like, there is, like, you know, there are grants for visual artists, and I feel like grants for musicians are harder to come by in a way where that allows kind of, like... and, like, experimental and weird things to happen. But, like, for the artist grant, like, getting that to do this makes so much circular sense to me. And I guess I like it when things make circular sense, where, like, you have this unexpected chunk of money to make a project, and then in my practice it just makes sense because, like, I always want to use it to not to, like, make things that express who I am, but make things that help me connect with people around me. Which, I mean, still selfish. It's just kind of selfish in a different way. Yeah. I'm a Virgo. Whatever. Whatever. I don't know. Go vote. It's important.
Yeah.
Talk to people about it. Who, like, throughout many years, like, friends, like, you know, people in the community were... Like, I'm not the most knowledgeable about politics, but I'm always like, find out enough to go vote. And they're like, yeah, I don't know. What's the point? I'm just like, now there is a point. Just go do it. Like, if at any point you felt bad about what's happening in the world, like, that's the reason why you should go vote. That's it. So I just, I don't know. That's like my weird PSA about voting. Yeah.
Great.
I think it's important. Okay.
Thanks, Casey.
Thanks, Adam.
That was my interview with Casey Wei at her karaoke music video free store set up in Chinatown. We spoke on the Record Store Day weekend. The bed music for that piece was Samaris. They are an Icelandic band. I don't know how to pronounce the name of this song. I'm going to try. I'm sorry, it's probably wrong. Hljóma Poo. Yeah. It's not correct. Up next, I'm going to play a track by Late Spring, one of Casey's musical projects. This is a preview of a song from their upcoming EP called Trembly Frog.
Thank you.
So that was Stormy by Late Spring and the very beginning of Jelly off of Invisible, which came out in May of 2016. The track you heard before that was their most recent preview from their upcoming EP, Trembly Frog. And again, Casey Way fronts band Late Spring, and she was who I spoke to about her karaoke music video Free Store in Chinatown. So keep an eye on Casey. She's always up to something really interesting. One of my favorite local artists and musicians, and hopefully now yours too. So thank you very much for tuning in to this week's episode of Shoes on a Wire. I had a lot of fun talking with Casey. The space was very interesting, and it solidified my love for karaoke. I would encourage everyone to try it if you haven't already. And coming up next, I've got a brand new show on CITR called Gal Dem with Roisin and Amna. No, not Amna. Mayan is her co-host this week. It's going to be very exciting. So stay tuned from 5 to 6:30 for that. And this is a friendly reminder, a PSA from me and Casey, that next Tuesday is May 9th, and that means that you, dear listener, need to get your butt to the polls and vote in the BC provincial election. It's a democracy, so you can vote for whoever you want, but I would really appreciate it if you didn't vote for Madam Christy Clark. And did some of your neighbors a favor and got rid of the Liberal Party. That's my personal opinion, not the official opinion of CITR, as we are nonpartisan. But Madeline Taylor does not want you to vote for the Liberal Party. So do with that what you will. Go to the polls and vote. And enjoy the end of this song by Late Spring. I'll talk to you next week. Take care.
May is Asian Heritage Month, and the Museum of Anthropology is inviting you to celebrate with them by seeing the exhibition Traces of Words, Art and Calligraphy from Asia, on from May 11th to October 9th. Words and their physical manifestations are explored in this exhibition, which will honor the special significance that written forms, especially calligraphy, hold across many unique cultures of Asia, a vast geographical area boasting the greatest diversity of languages in the world. Join MOA for the exhibit's opening with free admission on Thursday, May 11th from 7 to 10 p.m. In today's political landscape, more fires are raging out of control than ever before. Will you help put these fires out by registering to vote in BC's 2017 general election? You can vote in advance, mail in your vote, vote on the day of election, May 9th, or at any district electoral office. For more information about the process or to see where you can vote, visit elections.bc.ca.